afternoon, everyone. Sorry about the slight delay. Thanks for joining us again for this latest session of Lunchtime Takeaways with DPP. My name is Ollie Ritt. I'm your host for these sessions. I'm joined, as ever, by my two colleagues, Phil Browning and David Holmes.
Only just.
We do like to record these sessions, as you may know by now, and we put them out later as a podcast for those who weren't able to attend. Privacy notice in relation to that is on screen now. Do just let us know if you've got any issues. This week we're back with GDPR Radio, which is really becoming increasingly, we're all in agreement that it's a good thing, more and more of a space just for professionals in this area to come together to kick some ideas around, talk about what's been in the news, have a bit of a chat, basically. Please do get involved with any comments, questions, queries, concerns. Pop them in the chat or just unmute and dive in. We've had some really good interaction over the last few weeks, so hopefully we can keep that going. So we've got a couple bits on the docket to talk about first of all. I think two of the big ones this week are the new sound contractual clauses. Phil, you and I had a brief chat about that yesterday. Do you want to give us a bit of background?
Only insofar as that it would appear that the European Commission, is it, that approves these things, have approved standard contractual clauses and set a date of the 27th of June, so 20 days after they were published in the official journal, for them to take effect. And they've said that all no new contracts to be entered into on the old SCCs from September. Now, this obviously doesn't this is regarding the EU GDPR. So we're waiting to see what the ICO does and says. And I would think that they would follow suit and say, yeah, these SCCs, you know, rewritten, but probably identical, are suitable for the use in the UK for transfers to third countries. But that was interesting. I don't think I did download them. I've not scanned through them. There's a few minor changes from memory from the draft version, but nothing major, nothing significant. But it does mean that what we'll have to do is at some point repaper all of our international transfers. So if they're with third-party processors like, you know, Microsoft or Salesforce or SurveyMonkey or MailChimp, you know, they will issue at some point new master service agreements, which that's easy because they're usually, you know, actually pretty good and easy to accept and adopt. It's where we're maybe working with third party companies in third countries that, you know, we might have a bit of trouble in getting them all repapered.
It's interesting what you've said about the standard contractual clauses, because the one element of it in particular that we spoke about probably a while ago now, isn't it, Phil and Ollie, in relation to the essential guarantees. I think they call it the essential guarantees.
Yeah, European. Yeah.
That's it. And I'm sure there was some mention a while ago, and if it is, I hope you're going to claim a part of this, Phil, in relation to whether countries or organisations are going to make a commodity out of determining the lawful basis of the countries that the laws in which the country you're sending them to see whether it fits with your standard contractual clauses. You remember us having that conversation?
I do, yeah.
I'm led to believe from catching up with, unless Jason's on here and wants to unmute and jump in, catching with Jason yesterday, that DLA, was it DLA Piper, I think, he said, have more or less got something like that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Dave. I've been in touch with them. They've created a tool which is currently a complex Excel model, but they are recreating it in HTML, which effectively does the risk assessment on a contract by contract basis, because it invites you to key in not just the destination of the processor, but also to list all of the sub-processors for onward transfers. It's a very powerful tool, and I am following it up with a view to buying it for our organisation.
Yeah, I like DLA Piper. I mean, I don't know if you've done much work with them, but I think they're a really good law firm. And I went to school, actually, one of their partners who deals with the data protection stuff. So I think as a firm, I've got an awful lot of time for them. And then, of course, they produced years ago, well, a couple of years ago, the model processor contractual clauses that a lot of people are using for some time in the transitional period. I think I've seen some more models, Jason, as well. I think I've seen Bird and Bird, or Two Birds, have got. And there's a few law firms. I think, as I've seen another one, somebody on Stevens, Bolton and Stevens, they say they've got their own online tools to help you get through this and basically fill in the information and out pop the standard contractual clause. But again, these tools are going to be really helpful for us to standardise practice.
Yeah, what I like about this one, Phil, I mean, I'll have a look at the ones you've mentioned, but what I like about this is the way it gives you a risk score on a scale from 5 to 40, because it's never going to say you should not send personal data to this organisation. It's just going to say there is a high risk if you send personal data. And I don't know what the weighting in the algorithm is, but it's taking into account every aspect of the transfer. So the security measures, the legislation of the country into which it's being imported, whether the standard contractual clauses are in place and so on. It's a really powerful tool.
Oh, excellent. Well, I shall have a look at that. That's another good tip there. Thank you.
Okay.
I think
any other comments or questions about this anyone's got, maybe?
No, by all means. I was going to say that's probably quite a nice natural segue anyway into the other big news this week, which Dave Holmes broke the story on, it seems, which is adequacy potentially being agreed. Right, Dave?
For sure. I first came across a post yesterday relating to the fact that the UK's adequacy was voted on yesterday, and everybody or the voting parties unanimously have voted to approve the UK's adequacy arrangements. But I only had one link to it at that point, and I spent some time yesterday just seeing whether I could actually find any of the links to it. But the first link that I'd come across, an only link that I'd come across yesterday, was from Nets Politica. That first brought the story. However, this morning I've also seen that Reuters have also carried a similar story in relation to adequacy, and therefore, because it's now been approved, it's kind of had the vote and everybody's approved, it should now go through to enable the continuing transfer of data between the UK and the EU from the end of this month. Because don't forget, we had the 4+2 set up following Brexit, and we're now in the 2-month bridging period that comes to the end of this month. So it's it looks like the politicians have stopped throwing buns at each other and decided to eat them instead. So that's good in that sense. It's quite a positive thing. There is a little bit of confusion. It's been quite interesting to see how it might transit through. I was reading another article that somebody had put on LinkedIn earlier in relation to a kind of a bit of an immigration fudge, and how that may work, because there's still a bit of conflict between the two. Because don't forget, the European Commission had previously approved the immigration exemption, when it said that the laws were okay in that kind of sense, in a very kind of toned down version of what they've said. But basically, the EC approved it. The European Data Protection Board, if you remember, and the European Parliament both had reservations about it. And then the UK Court of Appeal went, well, actually, it's illegal. So now we've got the UK Court of Appeal saying that the UK's immigration exemption is illegal, but the European Commission saying, well, actually, we thought it was okay.
Great.
So we'll see. We'll best just keep an eye on it. Let's see what the text is when the full approved text gets published in the official journal and things. Whether that clarifies anything or not, I'm not sure. But it we are in this kind of sort of a bit of a standoff around the immigration exemption.
And yet another lovely analogy from you previously there, Dave, on bun size. I know you had another analogy that you put to me this morning when we were talking about it, which is this Tiger report. I know you wanted to talk about that. If there's anything else to be said on adequacy, by the way, please do jump in. But I know that's something you wanted to discuss.
Sure. We can all talk about the Tiger report shortly. It'll be interesting because it may link to adequacy, on depending whether. I mean, it's. I had seen some comments about whether the Tiger report was just a part of the political bun fight to get it approved or not, because of this threat to move away, and whether they'll actually still will now since we've got approval and bits and pieces.
Just remind us what this is. It's not about a fella in America, is it, who got locked up for killing that other type of person? Different report we're talking about here. Tiger.
Yeah, the Tiger report isn't about replacing the lion on the front of the tiger on the front of the Frosties packet either. Mm. But it's the report that the government's come out with, looking at kind of reducing kind of regulations and things. And within there was a bit on data protection, and it wants to have a look at data protection and kind of loosen some of the rules and regulations around that. However, the report, I don't know if anybody's actually read it or focused on the bit in data protection in particular, but I actually found, in essence, another summary, shall we say, from myself, is the fact that it looks like those who are seeking to change the law don't actually understand it.
I came to that conclusion as well. Yes. Yeah.
So for sure, we can certainly kick that one around a bit. In relation to adequacy, like I say, it's we'll have to see what no doubt we'll talk about it more once we've got the approved text, to see what the approved text says and if there's any details in there. For example, I have seen people online just talking about that the adequacy's not got a time period to it, not an end date to it. But again, we'll have to wait until we were just talking around kind of rumours, really. We've not seen the official text. So let's wait until the official text is out before we pull adequacy apart any further. But for the time being, anybody sending anything to Europe, it looks like it'll be okay for the time being. For how long?
It's funny you.
For the time.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the lifespan of adequacy, because Steph's asking us the million-dollar question. Are we willing to speculate on how long that adequacy might last? He says he won't hold us to at least not depending on our answers potentially. But any thoughts on that, gents, as to how long this might last and what a catalyst
I don't think from memory, and this is my very crunky memory here, I don't think that there are time limits placed on other adequacy arrangements, are there? I thought that it was mostly if you continue to comply, then we'll continue to rate you as adequate, and if you don't, then we won't. So I don't remember the Japanese I'm being corrected here, 4 years is usual review period.
I would, in response to the question of saying how long adequacy would last for, to be fair, I can't really answer that one based on the current government's approach to data protection. Depends how quick they move. If they decide to leave it a few years, and we might find adequacy lasts a bit longer. If we suddenly decide that in the field of madness and those that are making judgments on laws that they don't understand, and then start progressing those, and you might find adequacies either going to be a lot shorter, or you may find countries saying, well, you might have adequacy, but we still don't think it's good enough.
That's fair enough, I suppose. I've seen also this morning in other adequacy news, I think South Korea are going through the processes of getting adequacy, and the ball's been started rolling on that, which is interesting to see those operating in tandem. I think it will be interesting to see what, if any, effect this Tiger report has. I mean, I'll be honest, I've not had a chance to read it yet. I know you sent it around, Dave, but whether it ties into that broader data strategy that government have, and it all ties in line with Oliver Dowden's comments a couple of months ago, which we discussed at the time. So, well, interesting to see how that pans out. I don't know if anyone's got any other thoughts on that. Otherwise, we have been asked for an update on the National Housing Federation's code of practice that we've been working on. I think that's one really for you, Phil, to look at.
Yeah, I was just going to say that in my view is the Tiger Report does tie into the previous statements which we've discussed. But I mean, there's not a lot to it if you want to have a look through it. Or there's one paragraph on, you know, the early kind of summary bit, and then there's about 3.5 pages. But Dave's right, you know, in my view, but I've got a coloured view of the, you know, the GDPR and the data protection law. The view expressed in the report is highly prescriptive and confusing, and I think that data protection law in general as a field of work is highly confusing, rather than the law itself is fraught with difficulties. But I don't think it's prescriptive. There are not many things that the GDPR says you have to do this, and where it does, they seem perfectly reasonable for organisations to implement. The Tiger Report is saying that it wants to try and free up, you know, small businesses, medium sized enterprises from all this red tape. Now there is quite a bit of red tape, isn't there? I mean, just maintaining records processing activities, if you're not exempt, is a big order, isn't it? So it's a lot of work to do. But why would you not require people to keep track of what they're doing? It just seems that, again, they haven't got a full understanding, or they've got a very, I think, odd view of the data protection legislation and what is regulation, and, you know, and what's required and what's reasonable. And, you know, they use this word proportionate in the Tiger Report a lot as well. And, you know, in it.
Right, yeah, I agree with you there, Phil. I don't think they actually understand it. I'd be surprised if the report actually passed QA, to be fair. Unless they've just not had anybody with any kind of any DP insight or knowledge over it, because I think at point 209 it says that organisations generally need consent to process personal data. Well, I didn't think that was the case.
Yeah.
In that sense.
Yeah. But the problem is, there's people advising government, and government are going to make policy decisions, and, you know, potentially, you know, amend legislation based on what I would consider to be inaccurate advice.
I would agree. I actually don't necessarily find the current GDPR that inflexible. I think it's a case of understanding it, because it's not that prescriptive. I don't personally find it. Doesn't say you've got to, if you're a housing association, you've got to operate in this sense. And if you're a marketing company, you've got to work in this sense. It's there for an interpretation to be made and an understanding. And I don't necessarily find it that prescriptive or inflexible. I think it's a case of understanding it enough to work with it.
Yeah, and that kind of leads into the code of conduct, really. So I attended the Housing Federation's governance event yesterday, which was a virtual event. And we were talking, there's three or four of us talking about a code of conduct. So Article 40, as you know, the GDPR sets out that codes of conduct can be written for sectors, or, you know, specific business sectors, or to try and effectively fine tune, you know, what the GDPR is broad law for every organization across definitely the EU, EEA, if not the world. It tries to regulate, you know, extraterritorially as well. More on that later, if you remind me. You know, so then it provides for codes of conduct, you know, that can be drafted up for sectors. Now, when we started this work, there weren't any codes of conduct around, but now there's two that's been approved by the European Data Protection Board, one for cloud computing, one for cloud computing infrastructure providers, and they've been quite useful for us now to grab as a model. But we'd started off saying, like, you know, a code of conduct would be useful to address some of the points that clearly there's misunderstanding about, or confusion about, or they're just particularly tricky for the industry, because we keep getting questions into our support desk of, you know, the same type. You know, when is this type of organization a processor? What do we do about profiling? You know, what's fair game, what's not fair game? Tenant communications, you know, we're obliged to send out tenant communications. You know, what can we put in there to promote some of our services without engaging the pecker? All these things, we thought that would be really useful to spell out, you know, a framework in a code of conduct for the industry. And codes of conduct have got to be approved by the ICO, and they've got to have a monitoring body. So there is a bit of rigorous process behind it. So if you think that the GDPR is this broad thing, then in the fullness of time, codes of conduct can be developed for, you know, specific sectors or industries or types of issue. So it can be a EU-wide issue that's relevant to all organisations, could be enshrined in a code of conduct. Then you've got, over time, the ability to fine tune it into something that is more workable or gives more certainty and more standardized practice. And the code of conduct is optional, you know, so again, you don't have to sign up to a code of conduct, but much the same as with something like ISO 27001, you could work to the code of conduct, but not get certified against it. So all in all, I think that it's, you know, it's a good thing, and it adds some more degree of customization, if you like, of the law into a sector. So we've got to the point where we've drafted up a code of conduct for the social housing sector. There's about 19 different housing providers on a working party that's chaired by the National Housing Federation. So we were talking yesterday on the governance conference about it. And I think we've set ourselves a timetable, and we have the representative from the ICO there, and we've got a follow-up meeting with the ICO representative on code of conduct as well. So you know, we think that another 10 weeks, which is probably optimistic, to sort of bash it into shape and redraft it and set it out so it looks really nice and put the boilerplate around it. Then we've got to determine, you know, what sort of organisation is going to monitor the code as a code and what sort of organisation is going to monitor compliance with the code. And this needs to be an independent organization. So we've got some, or the National Housing Federation have spoken to some organizations about, you know, would they be prepared to act in that capacity. The ICO will definitely not sign this off if there's no effective monitoring of it. And then, you know, hopefully it goes through a 12-week process with the ICO. It'll probably have to go through, needs to go through consultation with the industry before that. So some of the questions yesterday were, you know, does it work for Scottish housing providers as well as English housing providers? Does it work for, you know, very small operators with six properties and those big ones with 60,000 properties? You know, is it too much red tape and bureaucracy, or, you know, bearing in mind those different types of operation? So there needs to be a consultation process. Again, the ICO won't sign it off, they say, unless there's been effective consultation with the industry. And then hopefully, you know, in several months' time, then there will be a code of conduct published with kind of a kite marking certification mechanism and some monitoring body in the future, hopefully before the end of this year. But again, if it's done right, then it should you know, make things easier, and it should lower the cost of compliance. It should make, you know, give people more confidence in making some of the tricky decisions over the way that they're handling particularly tenant data, but also employee data. So that's where we're up to, Ollie.
Fantastic. I don't know if anyone, particularly some of our housing guests on the session, want to jump in with any particular questions on that. But otherwise, thanks, Phil, for the update. You mentioned extraterritoriality. Extraterritorial. Well, yeah, you said more on that, so...
Yeah, only insofar as... Yeah, we mentioned the other week that... The Dutch regulator fined a Canadian company called LocateFamily.com, I think €50,000, and I think they said like €20,000 for every week that you don't appoint a representative. So this is for not being a representative. This is according to the news, of course. Well, I wrote to Locate.com and said, look, you might not be aware of this, but you also need to have a representative in the UK for providing service in the UK, and, you know, we'd be happy to have a conversation with you about that. And I got very much a two fingers back from them, saying, you know, we're Canadian, European law doesn't affect us, UK law doesn't affect us. So I'd be interested to see, you know, we said all along, didn't we, you know, somebody's going to challenge this extraterritorial reach. So far, you know, the likes of Facebook and Google and Apple haven't, or don't seem to have challenged it. They seem to have just accepted extraterritoriality. But anyway, I certainly got the feeling from Locate.com that they weren't going to entertain it whatsoever.
Interesting. Very interesting.
So what do you think their approach will then be? Do you think they'll just continue to ignore it until somebody enforces it? Yeah. Or do you think they'll pull back from offering the services extraterritorially?
I've got no idea, Dave. I mean, I think from the response that they're probably buried their head in the sand and until somebody gets some kind of effective mechanism for, you know, for pursuing them.
For sure, for sure. I wonder whether it's slightly not linked, but I wonder whether I think Ollie first raised it with me, so it's maybe actually turning a question around onto Ollie to do some talking. But the interesting outcome from the French in relation to IKEA, and whether that will have any bearing on organisations and how they approach compliance. Would you like to talk to us about that, Ollie?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Dave. It was an item on the list, so it's a lovely segue. You're coming from my job by the looks of it. but yeah, no, I think for those who haven't seen, IKEA, specifically IKEA France, that branch, have been fined, I think this week, €1 million for what is rather playfully perhaps termed as snooping on their staff. That's what the articles say, at least. But when we talk about snooping, this is actually really quite advanced. It's, we'll call it what it is. It's spying on their staff and potential recruits. So the infringements in particular relate to, I think it's about 400 employees over a number of years. And essentially, from the looks of it, it's basically the high-ups in the particular branches of IKEA France were in contact with both private security firms and French police force, and were asking them to effectively vet staff, look up their criminal records on the sly, make sure they haven't got any offences, etc. And while that's all pretty appalling, to be honest, in terms of how they've gone about it, what's really interesting out of this is actually the enforcement action which has taken place, which is that the executives of IKEA France themselves individually have been found liable. So using directors' liability, which we've talked about before, which exists under the DPA, doesn't it, in this country, but has yet to be used as far as I'm aware. But it has been used in France. So a number of execs have been fined large amounts, 10,000, 50,000 euros, and even handed suspended custodial sentences. So up to 2 years, I think, is the biggest one, which I think is frankly really good to see such strong enforcement being taken. I thought what was also very interesting, just quickly, is that not only have the IKEA execs been handed fines and custodial sentences, but also the director of the private security firm that engaged has been handed down a suspended custodial sentence and fine, which I presume is because there was a control relationship there, and therefore they've been found to be complicit with this activity, which is really interesting, I thought, and it's good to see. Sorry, Dave, you were going to jump in.
Yeah, no, I found it really, really interesting. It's not necessarily the fine of IKEA itself, but an article I read said that the former CEO got a €50,000 fine and a 2-year suspended prison sentence. And I think it goes to show just the enforcement levels that the French are taking. And then without trying to kind of wrap it all back around to adequacy, you remember when they were debating about adequacy and there was a kind of, was it the European Parliament or somebody criticised the ICO for not being active enough and not taking enough enforcement action. So it'd be interesting to see whether the ICO are eyeing this up as alternatives to demonstrating the fact that they've got some teeth themselves, or whether they'll continue to operate in the shadows of PECA, which appears to be where the fines are at the moment with the ICO. I found it interesting from whether it'll spur the ICO on to doing anything more serious themselves, but also highly interesting from the fact that they've actually gone after the individuals within the organisation, as you say, and quite sizable fines. I mean, a personal fine of €50,000 and a suspended 2-year prison sentence.
Yeah, it's pretty significant, and it's interesting when you highlight the parallels there with enforcement over here, because I'm happy to be corrected on this, but I've got a memory in the back of my mind, which is that the BBC were doing something similar to this for senior positions, where they were vetting potential members of staff, high ups anyway, against MI5, particularly. I mean, I know it hit its height in the 80s, but I think it continued until sort of worryingly recently, if I remember correctly. So certainly parallels, and as you quite rightly say, whether more stringent enforcement is going to come, and whether that might affect adequacy. But I thought it was excellent to see that particular type of enforcement being carried out. For sure. I don't know, Phil, if you had any anything to add on that.
No, not really. No, nothing at all. Except I got my, nothing really. What you say, it's good to see.
No, no, absolutely. There was something else I saw this week, Dave, that you put out, which is that I think there's been concerns raised by a watchdog over the use of live facial recognition technology. I don't know if that's something which you perhaps wanted to touch on quickly.
I'd seen that the ICO had put something out on the use of live facial images or recording of live facial images. In that sense, I've not really fully read about it. I've seen it, but I've not really heavily reviewed the article on that at the moment. So I can't take that one any further. I do apologise, Ollie. I am aware that the ICO has come out with something.
No, that's fine. It's interesting because we've raised it a number of times over the last few weeks, and in particular a couple of weeks ago, where we mentioned the use increasingly of AI as well in facial recognition, and even to the extent that I think they were trialing in China the use of emotional state recognition technology, so that the AI could work out what your emotional state was from live footage of you, which is frankly horrifying. Steph has just popped in the chat there what we're referring to, so thank you, Steph. I don't know if you want to jump on and discuss it, but it's an ICO opinion is what it is, actually, in relation to the use of live facial recognition technology in public places specifically, which I'd be interested to get into, but thank you for sharing that, Steph.
There was an article. It's not really related to data protection, but it's to do with recognition in that sense. And I don't know if you've seen it in the BBC about they've been using AI and image recognition in Africa to identify elephants that might be roaming through villages in order to alert the villagers. And all these scientists have been putting together this kind of technology, so the technology can now recognise shapes and distinguish whether it's an elephant or not an elephant, and set an alert off. So that kind of ties in loosely to that element that you were talking about previously. I just thought it's a bit of a fun thing to kind of link, maybe rather loosely, to the topic of facial recognition. In this case, if you've got a trunk, you may be warned in Africa that you're approaching them.
And Steph's beating you to the punch with a punchline there, saying the elephant in the room in respect of that.
Indeed. One of the things I noticed this week, Ollie, which I don't know if is on your list to talk about, is the European Data Protection Board issued an opinion on the lawful basis for processing credit card data or storing credit card data. So apparently over the pandemic, there's been an increase in organisations wanted to store credit card information because there's been an upsurge in transactions. It just makes it easier for repeat purchases. So this opinion is dated 19th of May, and it's really interesting to me because I'm a QSA for the PCIDSS. But basically saying that the only lawful grounds for storing credit card information can only be consent. So they're saying that it doesn't appear to be within the reasonable expectations of the buyer that their data is going to store, that credit card data is going to be stored for any longer than the transaction. And it's not required for fulfillment of the contract, because the contract to supply goods is completed once the payment is taken, or contract to take payment is taken. So I was just interested in the way that they'd structured their arguments. Again, we can look at this type of stuff and apply it, and the way that they've gone through the three-step process for looking at legitimate interests and determining that actually the individual's rights are out of balance and take precedent. And they describe they refer to the fact they've already described financial information and credit card information as, I think, highly personal, they call it, a highly personal nature. Data is of a highly personal nature. So not special category data, not personal data, but personal data of a highly personal nature. So that was interesting. So, obviously the PCIDSS says that if you want to store credit card information, then that's a business decision, but there's a whole ton of controls wrapped around that. What the European Data Protection Board now is saying is, and if you want to store credit card information, the only lawful grounds is consent. So again, probably not any major surprise, just interesting that they were getting involved in that and issuing that opinion. And the way that they stepped through it, again, I think is quite insightful.
Was that, just to clarify it, Phil, because I'm sure I've read that, was that consent for storing for future use? So if you store
correct.
Your,
yeah, Yeah. So what happens most of the time is that credit card information is stored in volatile memory just to complete the transaction and go through that process chain, etc. And then most vendors, merchants don't keep it because it's just so difficult, to get the controls in place to retain credit card data. But if you wanted to store it, and comply with the PCI DSS, what the European Data Protection Board are saying is the only lawful basis for doing that is consent. And then they're highlighting that consent must be free, specific, informed, and unambiguous, and that might actually be quite tricky to obtain.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting.
Do you have a link to that, Phil, out of interest, just because someone's asking?
I will have. I downloaded it as the opinions of PDF, but I'll find it and put the link in the chat if you'll just carry on without me. I can't do more than one thing at once. I'll have to do that while I'm... I'm looking now and I can't even get a word out. So carry on.
That's absolutely fine. Don't you worry. What I'd like to do at this juncture is... if possible, invite Stefan to just discuss the piece you've put in the chat there. And there's something else actually that I was going to bring up, which I've seen this week, which is something that we've discussed in the past. But I don't know if you wanted to hop on quickly, Stefan, discuss that case raised in Hamburg. No problem. Steph just saying, give him a second. That's fine. The other point that I was going to raise, and I'll just introduce it now, is that I came across a paper this week, which I thought was very interesting, from a group of European academics, which effectively covers the question of consent management platforms, and specifically whether those consent management platforms act as processors or as controllers. And I can pop a link to this in the chat for those that are interested. It looks like a really well-researched paper. I can't wait to get it properly.
Yeah, yeah.
But apparently the starting premise to it is that effectively the Interactive Advertising Bureau, so that's a European body that covers this sort of thing, are categoric on the fact that these consent management platforms are processors. And effectively, this paper takes a case study and disputes that claim and says that actually, in more than one instance, it's incredibly likely that they will be controllers. And I think it's an interesting topic, particularly, we raised recently on one of these sessions the idea that not only the consent management platforms, but perhaps those placing cookies on your website are going to be controllers as well, and where all of that might sit. I just thought it was very interesting.
Stick it on.
I agree.
Steph's got his camera on now, so he's obviously ready to strut his stuff. But stick the thing on them, because that sounds fascinating to read through, Ollie.
And Steph may have also got some opinions on that as well, because it certainly sounds very closely linked to bits Steph and I have been talking about previously.
Yeah, it's a piece from somebody in France has released that, haven't they?
Yes, it is. So the academics are from various universities, but they've come under a institute in Grenoble, in France.
Interesting piece of work. I mean, what's come about is that the online advertising industry, the ecostructure, has been under investigation for the past 2 years by the ICO, a gentleman called Johnny Ryan, a very interesting guy, used to work at Brave, and is effectively a whistleblower. But what he's done is he's worked with a German legal firm, and they've actually brought the case against three companies in Hamburg, one of which is the reseller, or effectively the agent, for the IAB TCF framework. And he's putting forward the fact that online advertising, if people aren't familiar with it, effectively what happens every time you go onto a web page, any sort of space which has got advertising on can be sold on an online auction, and that's sold effectively by saying this person's on this website, who wants to bid for them. And there's a massive industry that goes on behind this, which is actually looking at the establishing a link to the unidentified person. Big debate of whether they're identified or not, because you don't necessarily have their name and address, but you have a UID that's related to them, that's related to their search history. So what they've done is they've put this into Hamburg, which is quite interesting because the Hamburg DPA are very strict on this. There are people who last year put out guidance about not using Google Analytics on sites. So it's quite a clever place to go if you're going to do it. That's the place that I think they've gone for. And the big debate comes down to what these CMPs are. The IAB TCF, the consent framework, it's on version 2.0 at the moment. And that's the one that you see on most websites where you've got an option of 12 purposes for the purpose of processing data. It's a very convoluted component. I've been doing a little bit of work with the Association of Online Publishers, where we've been trying to identify for publishers the mitigating actions they should have. But it's also an interesting area for charities, because a lot of charities do a lot of advertising through this system. And it looks like it potentially could result in an expediation of the ICO investigation, which was put off a little bit for COVID, but has restarted recently.
Fascinating. I'll be honest, I did see the Johnny Ryan case being brought, but I have to be honest, I didn't make the link to this paper, just because I've not really had a chance to wrap my head around either properly yet. But it certainly caught my attention, yeah.
Yeah, the interesting thing there is that what you've got is the TCF, the consent framework, is a framework that's provided by the IAB. The IAB Tech Solutions, who are a US organisation. So they claim that they just provide the framework. The CMPs claim that they just provide the framework for people to put a consent banner up on their site. And there's a big debate about who's got responsibility for this. A lot of the debate is, I have this thing about cookies and CMPs, is that a CMP, if you're going to adopt data protection by design default, you shouldn't be able to load a cookie that you can't allocate. And most of them have got this unallocated. So there's a lot of discussion about who is actually controlling this, or if anyone is actually controlling this.
Yeah, certainly a lot to get your head around there. Because I'm sure we were talking previously about linking when you're looking at cookies on your website as well, with whether the controller, so in our case, either our cookies, because we've put them there, is a web host just putting them on. And when you look at your website, you've suddenly got cookies and you're kind of going, well, what the heck are these here for? And then who's using that information that's gained in that sense? Because if we were aware of them, then they're certainly not our cookies, you could argue. So then what's other people's uses of them? So I think it's a really fascinating area to kind of delve into.
I'm trying to find a link to it. I don't know if this is what Michael's for, but I watched a video, about a 6-minute video yesterday about you know, how the ad tech works. And I think there's three-digit code, so there's, 999 different segments and profiles. And this video was saying, for instance, I can't remember exactly what it was, like number 68. If you're a 68, then your income's lower than £10,000 a year. And so there's all these different profiles. And what you're searching for, you know, slots into profiles. So, you know, the argument is that people are identifiable as distinct from each other. Which then makes that information that relates to them personal data. You know, so you don't have to particularly name somebody, but the fact that you can make that identifiable. So I try to find the link to this video because it was really good. It put it into really simple terms and it was really short as well.
I think that's on the stuff that Johnny Ryan's put up there. It's quite an interesting, it's worth people having a look at just to become more familiar. Following our previous discussion, I keep falling into this phrase, it's anonymous data. And I just put in the chat, I think you've got, it's either not personal data or it's personal data and it's then gone through various states. So to be anonymized, it had to be personal data in the first stage. And this is something that a lot of the German sort of data protection authorities are very keen on. They're saying that if you're going to anonymize, you should put it through a DPIA. There's a big discussion about anonymization. If you do it properly, is equivalent to deletion.
Well, it is, isn't it? It's like a one-way hash. You know, it's the definition of anonymization is it's irreversible. So there is no key to reverse that anonymization process. It has to be something that's irreversible.
But then it comes down to, I think the Germans use a phrase, it's between absolute anonymization and I think it's practical anonymization is the phrase they use. Saying that practical means that it's anonymous today, but in 3 years' time, when the state of the art has moved on and technology has advanced, will it become unanonymizable, de-identifiable?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, ultimately, the accumulation of anonymized data about individuals, you know, potentially still eventually renders them identifiable.
Yeah, and I think that's where it comes back to the big issue that was regarding the NHS. The I was getting mixed up. The GRDP.
Yes, that one. Yeah, the new one. The GDG. Yeah, I know what you mean. GDPRDPA or something. Yeah. And that's what you're referring to.
But I think there's a disjoint between Joe Public and data protection people, as in what is anonymous.
Yeah, even the suppliers that we talk to, you know, they think because they've temporarily removed, you know, a person, you know, like unique identifier from data, it's anonymized. And we say to them, no, it's not, it's pseudonymized. You know, oh, yeah, but if somebody found it in the street, you know, and they went to reasonable length to repersonalize it, you know, they wouldn't be able to without the key. But, you know, if it's not irreversible to me, it's not anonymized.
Well, there's also another piece that Mozilla have just put out, I think it was yesterday, all to do with Google's Flock proposal for the replacement of third-party cookies, highlighting that the Flock will, it's dynamic, and therefore by tracking it over, doing a piece of time series analysis over it, you can then limit it down and then link it into other data as well, so it becomes personal data.
It's interesting. We'll tell you one thing. We haven't got a job doing it. We pitched for a piece of work, Steph. This company wants to do a global survey in 33 different countries, and they've asked us to advise them about privacy information requirements. And we still haven't established whether it's medical research, whether the data being collected is anonymized. We don't think it will be. They say, like everyone does, oh, it's anonymous response. It's done by SurveyMonkey. And we're kind of like, well, you've got to prove it to us, you know, that the information cannot be linked back to an individual. Because if there's only five people who've got this medical condition in Argentina, you know, and one's male and four are female, then the response from the male in Argentina makes him identifiable. Yeah, but anyway, that's requiring us to research these 33 different laws. Now, of course, what we know as personal data is called something different in America. Personal identifiable information is called something different in Brazil and Argentina. So, you know, it's going to be a fascinating piece of work if we get it, because it will require us to, you know, get a hedge around all those different definitions and figure out, well, does this stuff that we're processing here fall into these definitions? Sorry, I interrupted you. You were going to say something.
No, so that's fine. I mean, I'm trying to find, there was an IPEN event this week, which talks about anonymization and synthetic data. There's a guy there speaking about health data. I'm just trying to find it, and I'll pop it in there. It's worth looking at, because it comes back down to the fact that the moment you say SurveyMonkey, somebody's response is personal data. You've then got to put in place the processes and the mechanisms to prove that you've anonymized it.
Mm.
And I think that's the mentality you've got to go from. You've got to assume it's, we have the phrase innocent until proven guilty. I think you've got to have it's personal data until proven not to be.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right.
I very much agree. I had, sorry,
but particularly if it's a digital thing, if it was a piece of paper that got filled in and submitted, you know, in personal via the mail, that's different. But digital stuff has by definition, has got kind of footprints behind it. So, you know, I'm waiting to be convinced that, one, it is not personal data. And two, if they're collecting information about symptoms, you know, these symptoms people suffer from this particular rare form of blood cancer, You know, to me, that's data concerning health. So in EU and in the UK, that would be special category personal data if it's personal data. Anyway, yeah. Sorry, Ollie, yeah.
No, I was going to say, I was only going to add in an instance where I had a bit of a set to with one of my client's suppliers because they were categorically stating that what they were collecting wasn't personal data, despite that there was very clearly a user ID that could tie it back to specific users. But that was all related to health data as well, and that went on for far too long, to be honest.
There's a big misunderstanding generally. Within the privacy professionals of what is personal data, you know, and the lay people think that, you know, your personal data is your name and address and everything, not the any information relating to, you know, an identifiable data subject, you know, but I have spent ages, I've just done a training course, you know, we did an online training course for introduction to data protection, but trying to get across the concept, you know, the definition of personal data without verbatim using the GDPR, which frankly leaves you more confused than it doesn't. You know, I found that really difficult because you're trying to get across of the point that it is all information relating to a data subject, because that's what the law says. And then you're trying to think, well, what is a data subject? You know, somebody who's identifiable from, or it can be identified from that data. On the face of it, it's a simple definition, but actually when you're working with it, it's not. It's really, really, really hard.
I was going to say, in terms of from a database perspective, name is not actually a good match key. So
no, I know. Yeah.
Is STEF or is it double F or is it PH? Yeah. So what you'll utilise is a unique reference number. A unique reference number means that it's easily indexed. But it's also then easily to match. So when you do joins across tables, you've got, you know, speed of join.
Yeah.
And you ensure in greater, it's a better process for data protection purposes because you're making sure the data is actually correct. But it's, you know, from a perspective of recognizing somebody, when you go on a website, unless you're logging in, somebody's using a URN or an ID to identify your machine and then by default identify that as yourself.
You see, you don't want to say anything now, do you, Dave? What were you going to say?
I was just trying to note down what I was going to say just in case I'd forgot.
Sorry.
In that, it's just been a bit of a long week. No, you're fine, Steph. Well, I was going to come back to, and I actually agree with everything that you're saying there, Steph, but I think that some of the problems is potentially the training, because people try to boil things down in order to make them understandable to many. So what you've got is a simple term, and I agree, when you work with it, it gets rather complex, but when you're trying to tell people what personal data is, you find the default settings, well, personal data is like your name, your address, your contact details. And it's kind of a heavy focus, maybe inadvertently, on maybe only being able to directly identify people by looking at things like unique identifiers. So your name, your address, your telephone number, your habits at work, that kind of stuff, without necessarily expanding and considering things like, and as Steph alluded to and Ollie many times, that things like your cookie IDs aren't necessarily able to identify you directly, because it doesn't necessarily have your name and address and contact details in there, but it's sufficient, cookies are sufficient to identify you or to separate you out from anybody else because of your behaviour. And I think sometimes, whether it's the training and trying to get everybody to understand it from a general sense, that the nuances are generally lost,
I think,
potentially.
I'm just starting to get shot down in flames here, but my view, name and address, I'm going to throw it out there. That's not personal data. That's identifiers. That's a way of identifying people. It's the other information that relates to the people associated with those identifiers. That's the personal data. You know, I'm horrified this morning. I got a note from Google saying, do you want to have a look at where you've been in May? You know, and I must have opted into this. It's tracked me all over the country in May. I've done 1,400 miles in the car, according to this, and one mile walking. I'm not sure where they got that from, but it's putting up these lists of places. I've been to Bangor, I've been to this place. I sat outside a pub waiting for my daughter, who was at a friend's house, which is across the road from the pub. So it's saying, assuming I've been to the pub, and it's giving me an advert for this pub in Faceby, near where I live. So that's the personal data.
Absolutely, and that's the point I'm trying to get to, is whether with the training that people's had and the understanding that they kind of go back to maybe simple terms. So if you've got to identify somebody, is it the name? Now, I'm not necessarily saying it's right, but I do see examples when people are talking about personal data. It's personal data, like your name, your address, that kind of stuff. In that kind of sense, without actually, as you mentioned, is that your personal identifier, or is it actually something about you in that sense? And I just sometimes wonder whether it's training related and trying to simplify things so people understand it. But simplifying it too much, you're getting it wrong by simplifying, because like I say, it's, if you actually look at the definition, it's a two-part test. You've got to be identified, then it must relate to. The identification on its own is just an identifier.
Yeah. But what Steph said a minute ago about, you know, the state of the art will move on, and therefore depersonalized data may become personal data in the future. Again, that's a feature that's been with us for some time. You famously remember the ICO's guidance, you know, a paper on what is personal data, where they were using the example of the estate agent's window. I've gone on about this hundreds of times, you know, and somebody takes a picture of the estate agent's window for the purposes of promoting the estate agent, and there's people looking in the window, and that information is not personal data about those people looking in the window, because the photograph is not being used to identify them. It's being used for purposes of promoting the estate agent's business, according to the ICO's guidance. However, if there's a bank robbery two doors up, and the police ask for those photographs in order to see if they can identify the bank robbers, all of a sudden that information, those images, become personal data because it's being used to identify people. So when you start factoring in that's official advice, it's no wonder people get confused. I mean, how on earth are you meant to work with this woolly moving target?
But there's a context component that comes into that. And, you know, you look at the moment, I've spoken to a number of people about things such as Facebook custom audience, where you load up your email addresses into Facebook and therefore it enables you to advertise to that audience on Facebook. You've got to look at what's the purpose of the processing, and was the person who provided you their email to get an update, did they actually agree or know that you were then going to utilize it for that? And then your, you know, data protection people load up your audience onto Facebook. That information goes to Facebook.
I remember covering that. Yeah, I know what you're saying, Steph. I looked at this with a client that Jason and I worked with many years ago, actually. And they were using Facebook lookalike audiences. But in order to find people who look like your audience, you had to load up the audience of your existing clients. So we had to change the privacy policy. Oh, by the way, we're going to use your personal data or information we've got about you in order to identify other people that look like you on the Facebook marketplace. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
And Facebook then get that piece of information. You know, there's a component about using hashed email addresses going forward for data sharing. You know, if I go on to boots.com and then I go to NottinghamForest.com, do I really mind that the two are linked together? Maybe not. But if I were to link that to something more medical and to Boots, and you can see that I'm going to Boots and the medical company can see that, you start getting into that component of sharing of information that goes beyond my degree of comfort that it should be shared.
It's an interesting area. I mean, what struck me when I sat outside what it's called the black sheep in Faceby is, where else have I sat outside that Google's assumed I've been into? Could be quite interesting. Anyway, on that note, better hand over.
On that note, less said about that, the better, I think.
I think that could be the topic of the next
I shall share my month tracking information from Google. Yes, maybe not.
Dear me. Rightio. Well, we've done it again. We've somehow managed to fill an hour incredibly quickly with all of that. I don't know if there are any final closing questions or points anyone wants to chuck in to kick around quickly. I mean, we will be back next week as ever. We've got some special sessions lined up next week, actually, a word on that in a minute. But unless there's anything else, I'd like to thank both you, Dave, and Phil for helping me out once again with this. I'd like to thank Steph and Jason for hopping on and everyone contributing in the chat. It's always great when we get people involved and kicking these ideas around. And so we're back next week. Phil, Dave, I think you've potentially started putting some thought into it, haven't you, to what we're doing. Do you want to brief us on that?
You're on holiday next week, aren't you, Ollie?
Yeah, I'm not here next week. You get a treat.
Yeah, I think Friday next week I'm sick.
Right, okay. Well, to be fair, Ollie, we haven't put much thought into it. The idea was to try and have what was going to be a workshop of some description, but that requires it to be interactive and useful instead of it just being a load of old hot air. So we have to put some thought into that. But the idea was to try and do some practical things, but we haven't yet figured out what those are, unless you've done more work on it than me, Dave.
We will get there by next week.
There you go, Ollie.
Sounds good. I'll I might come and listen in and just sit quietly in the audience for once. Rightio, on that note, thank you all very much for joining us, and we'll hope to see you very soon next week, hopefully.
Have a good weekend, everyone. Thank you.
Yeah, have a good break. Thanks for joining us, everybody, and everybody who took part and joined in. It's been a really successful session for myself, so thank you very much.